From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, helping the body heal itself, we talk with Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing. Weil says modern medicine knows how to fight disease, but it doesn't focus enough on strengthening our own body's defenses. He advocates combining the best of alternative and standard medicine into what he calls integrative medicine. Also today, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD set of Andrew Hill's complete Blue Note Sessions, 1963 to 66. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new bestseller, Spontaneous Healing, Dr. Andrew Weil argues that modern medicine is too focused on fighting the agents of disease. Weil says we can be doing more to work with the body's defenses, to strengthen the body's natural ability to heal itself. Weil is a graduate of Harvard Medical School and an authority on alternative medicine. He advocates what he calls integrative therapy, which is incorporating alternative forms of medicine into standard treatment. He currently directs the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Weil is also an ethnopharmacologist who has studied the healing and mind-altering effects of plants. For 15 years, he worked with the Harvard Botanical Museum. His previous books include Natural Health, Natural Medicine, and Health and Healing. I asked him for an example of how doctors fight disease as opposed to working with the body's ability to heal.
I suggested that people look at the names of categories of drugs which are popular in medicine today and notice how many of them begin with the prefix anti. We use antihistamines, antihypertensives, antispasmodics, anti-anxiety drugs, antiarrhythmic drugs. This is the nature of standard medicine. It uses a great many counteractive and suppressive measures. I think those measures have their place. If symptoms are very severe or life-threatening, obviously you want to counteract them. So as a short-term strategy, that's okay. But my worry is that if you rely on these methods long-term, there are two problems. The first is that you expose patients to unnecessary harm because these kinds of measures by nature are toxic. Secondly, by suppressing illness and counteracting symptoms, I think you often unwittingly strengthen disease processes. You frustrate their expression and make them more resistant to resolution over time. The other approach is to work with the body's natural potential for healing. I think there is a strong tendency of the body to return to a position of health when it's out of balance, because when it's healthy, everything is running most efficiently and using least energy. I think medicine should work from the premise that the body wants to get better and to help it along.
You're particularly suspicious of the kind of medicine that suppresses symptoms, like suppressing a rash with cortisone cream, over a long period of time.
Yes.
As opposed to a problem that you could just treat for a few days and that's that.
Exactly.
What are your fears about what happens when you suppress symptoms for a long time with a pill or an ointment?
I think there are several things that can happen. The first is that the disease can become more resistant to treatment in the future so that you have to use larger and larger doses of the suppressive measures. A second possibility is that the disease process may spread to other organ systems. That is, it may become more extensive in the body and take worse forms. One example that I gave in the book, Spontaneous Healing, is of a woman I saw who had an autoimmune disease called scleroderma, in which the skin begins to harden. This can produce internal symptoms as well, and especially in the digestive system. She was put on large doses of prednisone and immunosuppressive drugs and fairly quickly went into remission. The disease disappeared from her skin. The visible signs of it were gone. But about a year later, she developed shortness of breath. It turned out she had a rare condition called pulmonary fibrosis, in which normal lung tissue is replaced by useless fibrous tissue. This was clearly an unforeseen consequence, I think, of the use of that kind of suppressive therapy. The same disease process was present in her body, but it now had been driven inward to a much more vital organ, and one which is much more difficult to treat. So I think this is an illustration of the problem of using these kinds of methods over long periods of time.
What's an alternative to suppressing symptoms?
I work with many people with autoimmune diseases, things like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, and so forth. I think by really making changes in all aspects of lifestyle, especially by making changes in diet that can retard inflammatory processes, by using the mind-body connection, which I think is very obvious in these kinds of disorders. The ups and downs of these autoimmune diseases clearly parallel ups and downs of mental states. There are herbs that can be useful. There are some vitamins and supplements that can help retard inflammation. Proper forms of exercise can be very useful. So I think you really want to look at adjusting lifestyle in all aspects and working from the premise that people can get better. I must say that I think one of the most valuable things I do for patients is simply tell them with the authority of a medical doctor that I believe it's possible for them to get better. And many patients tell me they've never heard a doctor say that before.
Well, you know, in a lot of modern medicine, when we talk about the mind-body connection, it's kind of described as the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
And when you use the word placebo effect, it's usually in the context of controlled experiments, and it's something, you know, we can't really count that the person got better because it was just the placebo effect.
I think what you say there, that phrase, just the placebo effect, is perfectly representative of the way conventional doctors think of this phenomenon. The
mm-hmm.
placebo response, I prefer to call it, is regarded as a nuisance. It's something that messes up your experiments, and we're constantly trying to rule out placebo responses. I think we should be worrying about ruling them in. They're really the meat of medicine. Placebo responses are pure healing responses from within, elicited by belief, unmixed up with the direct effects of treatments which are likely to be harmful. I think the best kind of medicine is the gentlest treatment that produces the maximum healing response. So I think that I'm really working to try to educate doctors to see that placebo responses are their greatest therapeutic ally.
Well, how can doctors work with the placebo effect?
You know, I've always maintained that medicine is an art, not a science. I think it uses the forms of science, and it uses information produced by scientific research. But the manner of interacting between a practitioner and a patient is an art form. It involves intuitive sensing of a patient's belief structure, presentation of treatments to patients in ways that interact most profitably with their belief system in order to increase the probability of healing. That does not mean tricking patients. It doesn't mean giving them sugar pills or dummy treatments. It means giving treatments that you genuinely believe in and that you can present with conviction that will impact on their belief system as well, so that whatever the direct effect of the treatment is, you will also get a big halo of a placebo response. That is, you will interact with the body's own healing system.
I'm a very skeptical person by nature, but I find when I'm going to a doctor, particularly if it's any kind of like alternative medicine kind of thing, that I really want to believe because I figure, you know, I want that placebo effect to work for me.
You know, everyone wants to believe when you go to doctors. And I think that doctors are not very well trained in handling that projection of belief onto them. We don't train doctors in this art form of medicine. We don't teach them about the power of words and how to be extremely careful in choosing the words you say to a sick person.
Well, let me ask you this. When you are taking a potent medicine, do you read all the side effects or do you not want to know? Because there's that other aspect of it, too, you know, that the mind is very impressionable.
Sure.
And if you're preparing
sure.
for accelerated heartbeats or,
sure.
or a rash on your skin, you know, I always feel, well, you're more likely to get it.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't very often take potent medicines. I
uh-huh.
mostly use practice
right.
what I preach. I generally take care of things in myself by taking herbs, by following practices that I recommend myself, which are, because they're natural and dilute, don't have that kind of risk.
Though I should interrupt here and say that one of the things you do preach is that there is an appropriate time, even if you're into alternative therapy, there isn't an appropriate place for conventional
Absolutely.
Modern medicine.
Absolutely. And I think the great challenge for both doctors and patients is to learn how to recognize and sort out those conditions that should go to standard medicine without delay.
Right, right.
You know, and once you do that, then you have a lot of latitude to experiment with the rest. I think in many cases, the conventional treatments should be regarded as last resorts. You do them after you've exhausted simpler, gentler remedies. If those don't work, you can always go to these strong invasive techniques.
It's funny you should say that, because I think it's usually the other way around, is when people give up on conventional medicine that they end up seeking alternative therapies.
I think that's true in my own practice. I see that most patients who come to me are people who have really exhausted conventional medicine and often been hurt by it, and this has made them realize that they have to be responsible for their own well-being, and they have to get out there and search for information about other ways of doing it.
Getting back to the side effects for a second. So
yeah.
In the days when you were taking potent
yes.
medicines, would you read the side effects?
I think I would skim over them quickly and assume that I was not going to experience them, that they were statistically less frequent. And I very much believe in playing the odds. You know, this is another point. I think that most medical doctors don't realize that science has changed very much. We are no longer living in a Newtonian Cartesian universe. We live in a quantum universe where all is probability. There's no certainty. And if you want to live well probabilistically, you have to learn how to be a good gambler. You have to know how to play the odds. And in looking at these potent drugs, the odds are that you're not going to get these statistically less frequent side effects. So I think you can take some comfort from a probabilistic view.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the new book, Spontaneous Healing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Weil is my guest. He's the author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing. The place where the mind-body connection really backfires for me is those occasions where a doctor might think that it's your fault that your problem isn't clearing up. You know, that they've done their job. You know, now it's your turn. And that, you know, you're responsible if you're not getting better.
You know, I was just reading a text that's coming out about Asian healing traditions, and there was a scholarly article about Ayurvedic medicine and its development from ancient India to the present. And there was a treatise written, this must be something like the 2nd or 3rd century AD, that was talking about why patients don't get better. And some practitioners were saying that it was the patient's fault. Mm-hmm. They didn't follow the instructions. It was their problem. So this is nothing new. But I do think that in recent years, there have been a lot of popular books and New Age therapies which have really tried to argue that disease is a matter of choice in some way, that we give ourselves illnesses, and therefore, if we don't get better, it's our fault. I deplore that kind of writing and argument. I think it's very destructive. Let me give you an interesting example mm-hmm. that I used in the book. When I was at Harvard Medical School in the late 60s, when I would see women with breast cancer, who were mostly women of my grandmother's generation, and I would ask them why they thought they got breast cancer, they always would answer that it had to do with a past injury. It was 20 years ago, I fell against the table and hurt my breast. Now, that idea has no validity, but this is what women thought back then. Today, when I ask women why they think they get breast cancer, no one ever mentions an old injury. Today, it's all, I bottled up my feelings for all those years, or I never expressed the grief I felt about this and that. That's a very significant change in our culture. And I think it has to do with the popularity of all these books about emotional bases of illness. But the problem with it is that it creates a great deal of guilt. And I think that guilt is not a mental state that facilitates healing. So I don't think that's a useful way to think at all.
Well, I think people really do feel responsible for their own illnesses now, that you brought it on yourself in some emotional, psychological, or physical way.
I think there's the element of responsibility comes in more with lifestyle choices that we make. For example, if a person chooses to smoke tobacco, I think they have made a lifestyle choice that has gotten them into an addictive pattern of behavior that may create health consequences in the future. But that's different from saying that you're responsible for having cancer because you didn't express emotions and that you're in some way a bad person. I also mentioned in the book that there's a very interesting study that was done looking at how saints have died in this century. A remarkable number of saints, both Eastern and Western, have died of cancer.
Isn't that reassuring?
It's very reassuring.
What do I mean by that? It means that cancer isn't an expression of, like, your ugly soul or something.
Or a spiritual failing.
Exactly.
It almost looks like an occupational hazard of sainthood.
Now, there's a reverse side of the placebo effect, and you call it the hexing effect. When a doctor says to you, well, I'll give you 6 months to live. It doesn't look good. Nobody gets better with this.
And unfortunately, I think this is extremely common. And I would predict that if you or your listeners just ask in your own circle of friends and acquaintances, you will hear amazing numbers of stories of this kind, that many, many patients have been told in one way or another by doctors that they're not going to get better. Rarely is this done deliberately. Doctors aren't out to make patients feel devastated. It's usually done completely unthinkingly and unconsciously. And to me, it reveals two things. The first is, as I said earlier, that most doctors are really not trained in the art of using words and have no sense of the impact of what they say on patients. But secondly, and I think more worrisome, it reveals deep pessimism in the medical profession about healing. And I think this is a consequence of our not making healing a focus of what we do in medicine. We don't study it. We don't teach it to medical students. We don't systematically collect cases of spontaneous healing. This is not a subject of research. It's not something that's taken seriously. When doctors encounter very dramatic cases of unexpected recovery, these are usually regarded as interesting anecdotes. They're not made centerpieces of the medical model. And I think as a result, our doctors are very pessimistic, and they convey that pessimism in very unconscious ways to patients. But I think that often has very destructive effects, because obviously if belief is one of the major avenues that impacts on the healing system, to have a medical authority tell you that you're not going to get better is a major influence on your belief system.
If you see somebody who has a condition and everyone else you've seen with that condition has died within 6 months, what are you going to say?
I'll say that I don't know whether they can get better, but here are things you can do to help yourself in whatever time you have remaining. That you can feel better, you can lead a more productive life. I work with many patients who have cancer. Most of the people that I work with who have cancer are doing some form of conventional therapy. They want to know what else they can do to improve their chances. And typically, if they ask their oncologists about food and diet, the answer they get is, well, it doesn't matter, just eat a balanced diet. That's not good enough. We know a lot of things that people can do with diet that can improve immune function.
What is spontaneous healing?
I use the word spontaneous there to suggest that this is healing that comes from within, that comes of itself. When you cut your finger, you don't have to believe that your finger is going to heal. You don't have to have somebody pray over it to heal. It heals because the body has the capability of repairing damage in that way. That's something we can see on the surface of the body, but that healing activity goes on at every level of biological organization. In the book Spontaneous Healing, I have a chapter on glimpses of aspects of this healing system at work. One of the examples that I looked at is the repair of DNA. DNA is a very big, complicated molecule. It performs complicated functions. Many things can go wrong in those functions. It can become injured. It can make mistakes. Those mistakes would be disastrous. But in the course of evolution, the DNA molecule itself has created enzymes that it makes for repairing itself. And really, this is a kind of molecular version of cut and paste that goes on all the time in every cell, that damaged bits are snipped out, new structure is replaced. This is a well-known phenomenon. It's taught in biochemistry courses in the first year of medical school. But I think its significance is not seen. This is a real window on the essence of healing, which is spontaneous, even going on at this very basic level of life that's an interface between life and non-life. And I think at any level of biological organization, you can see the same aspect. That is, there is an innate, inborn capacity to diagnose problems, to repair damaged structure, to regenerate lost or missing structure. And I think that this should be the primary focus of medical research, medical teaching, and medical practice.
What would you most like to know now about how the body heals itself?
Well, I'm fascinated by the regenerative potential of the human organism. I mentioned in the book that the liver has spectacular regenerative capacity. You can amputate 2/3 of a liver in animals, and in 24 hours, the remaining bit can regenerate the whole organ. Why can this go on in the liver? Why can't it happen in heart muscle? that's lost to a heart attack, for example? Why doesn't it happen if a spinal cord is injured? This capacity for regeneration is a potential within DNA. There are sequences of DNA which, if active, can stimulate the whole sequence of chemical reactions that lead to regeneration in this way. But as cells become more specialized, like heart muscle cells, those sequences of DNA become turned off. But I think it's important to realize that the potential is there. And the problem is, if we can figure out how to turn on the right switches, we might be able to stimulate regeneration in that way.
With many illnesses, including cancer, no matter how grave the condition is, there's usually a very, very, very small percentage of people who get better.
And that's
usually dismissed as, well, you know, these people, it's the luck of the draw. These people are, you know, it's not necessarily something they did.
Right.
Some people will just naturally get better, but, you know, you can't count on it. What are you trying to do with those exceptional people? What are you trying to learn from looking at
them? I
want
to study them. I want to see this looked at as a serious phenomenon. I want to see us systematically collect cases of this kind, analyze them to see what patterns are there. Mm-hmm. And by the way, cancer is the worst place to look.
Why?
Because it's a special case. The problem is that by the time a cancer is detectable in the body, that already represents a long-term failure of the body's healing mechanisms. In order for a malignant cell to develop into a detectable cancer, this is a long period of time over which all of the body's healing mechanisms have failed. So yet even in that case, we see these cases, relatively rare, of remission. But if you look elsewhere, if you look at other categories of disease, such as autoimmunity, chronic pain, allergies, you see this phenomenon of remission and recovery very, very common. In fact, in some diseases, it's the rule rather than the exception. I think we've made a mistake in what little bit of research has been done on healing has almost entirely been focused on spontaneous remission of cancer. I think that's a tactical mistake. There are much better places to look. But I think if we looked in a systematic fashion, we would begin to see patterns and commonalities that might enable us to make this happen more frequently. I've suggested that we should create a National Institute of Health and Healing within the National Institutes of Health. You know, really, I think our National Institutes of Health are misnamed. They are really National Institutes of Disease and Body Parts. And I think that is representative of the disease focus of medicine rather than the health focus. But if we had a National Institute of Health and Healing, I think one of its functions should be to maintain a national registry of cases of healing that would be extensively cross-referenced by categories of disease, so that, for example, if you develop scleroderma, you or your doctor could call the National Registry and get a list of people who have experienced recovery from scleroderma in your area, and you or your doctor could interview them and find out what they did, and that might give you suggestions for what to do.
Of course, the things they did might not be related at all to their recovery. It might be coincidental.
That is certainly possible. In the cases that I've presented in the book, there is one pattern that I've seen that's interesting, is that often healing has followed a very dramatic mental shift, a shift in outlook in which people have dropped the stance of fighting the illness and instead have come to a place of resignation or submission in which they have totally accepted themselves, including the fact of present illness. And somehow, immediately following that shift, a healing response has occurred. That's interesting because I think our culture tends to teach people that the appropriate mode of dealing with a serious illness is to fight.
Dr. Andrew Weil is the author of Spontaneous Healing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Andrew Weil will be back with us in the second part of our show. We'll be right back.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, combining the best of alternative and standard medicine, we continue our conversation with Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD set of Andrew Hill's complete Blue Note recordings, 1963 to 66, which we're listening to now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the bestseller Spontaneous Healing. It's about how we can strengthen the body's natural ability to heal itself. Dr. Weil is a graduate of Harvard Medical School and an authority on alternative medicine. He advocates combining the best of standard and alternative medicine into what he describes as integrative medicine. Weil directs the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona in Tucson. You have almost like guidelines in your book about where you think conventional medicine is useful and where you think it's not. You want to run through that for us?
Sure. If conventional medicine is outstanding at the treatment of trauma. If I were in a serious car accident, I wouldn't want to go first to an herbalist or an acupuncturist. I'd want to go to a trauma center. It's also, for the moment, good at dealing with acute bacterial infections and in general with crises, with surgical crises like an appendix that's about to rupture or medical crises like a heart attack or pulmonary edema. So for these kinds of things, that's you use conventional medicine. It's good at reconstructive surgery and cosmetic surgery when these are used appropriately at high-risk obstetrical cases. In general, as I said, at crisis medicine, the problem is that we're so good at this that we now tend to treat every condition as if it were a crisis or emergency, and we bring out the heavy artillery as the first line of intervention. And I think that is why we have a healthcare crisis today. That's why we produce the kind of harm we do in medicine. So it is a real challenge for both doctors and patients to learn to use this system appropriately. My estimate is that it's appropriate for about 10 to 20% of cases of illness.
What kind of problems would you immediately yourself seek alternative therapy for?
Allergy, autoimmunity, that's the lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma kind of thing. Most mental disorders, certainly anxiety disorders and panic disorders, chronic pain, chronic back pain, chronic neck pain, a lot of problems of chronic infection or susceptibility to infection, which represent depressed immunity, you know, whether that's very severe as an infection with HIV or minor as in people who just get every bug that's going around. Now, these are big categories of illness, also for, I would say, most gastrointestinal disorders, most skin disorders. I would use conventional medicine in those cases only after I had really done a thorough search and experimented with alternative methods.
You were trained in mainstream medicine. Why did you decide to not practice it yourself?
I never practiced it, and I thought this way before I went to medical school. I'm a botanist by training as well as a physician. I did my undergraduate degree in botany. I have a lifelong interest in plants and a long research interest in medicinal plants. So I've always been interested in nature and the relationship between nature and healing. When I finished my clinical training, I saw what that system was good for, but it seemed to me it produced too much harm. And I really felt I had learned nothing about how to prevent illness, and that seems to be the main function of doctors. It should be. It should be. Doctors should be teachers who teach people how not to get sick in the first place. So I set out to travel around the world and look at healing practices in other cultures and gradually put together my own eclectic blend of medicine.
Since you believe that a lot of illness has some kind of psychological component to it, when you're taking a medical history of a patient who you're treating for the first time, what do you want to know about them?
I really want to know what makes them tick. I want to get a picture of what this person is like. So I ask a lot of very nosy questions about, what's their job like? How do they like it? What is their sex life like? What kind of friends do they have? What do they do for fun? All this, by the way, falls under an area of the medical history called the social history. And this is the first part of the history that medical students and young doctors learn to jettison when they're under time pressure to work with patients. You know, this is considered the soft part of the medical history that's expendable. So it gets cut down to nothing. And my experience is that it is in this area, by asking these kinds of questions, that I most often find the clues to the nature of a problem and possible ways of remedying it.
I'm going to ask you about coffee because you've written a lot about it. And it seems like every couple of years a new study comes out that maybe contradicts a study that came out 2 years before. What's your latest thinking about coffee and decaffeinated coffee and the effect it has on the body, on the immune system, on stress, on the digestive system?
Sure. When I take a medical history from patients, I'm very interested in their drug history. Most of the patients that I see are users of legal drugs. Only a few are users of illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in uses of caffeine. I think that of all the caffeine forms of caffeine, coffee is the strongest and the one that's most associated with problems. It is a strong stimulant. It is addictive for most people who use it. I would estimate that about 80% of people who use coffee are addicted, meaning that when they stop, they'll have a withdrawal syndrome. And the withdrawal syndrome is fatigue and a vascular headache, which can be incapacitating, usually lasting for 1 or 2 days. I think that coffee, that there's a lot of individual sensitivity to coffee, but in many people, I think it is the primary cause or an aggravating cause of symptoms, particularly in the stomach and esophagus, the lower intestinal tract. So if people have stomach pain, digestive problems, irritable bowel syndrome, they should not be using coffee. If people have insomnia, they should not be using coffee. And even coffee taken early in the day can cause insomnia or sleep disturbance at night. It can cause restlessness. It can cause anxiety. It can cause heart arrhythmias, really a whole variety of problems. And the only way you find these things out is to stop it and see what happens to you. I would still maintain that I produce about one miracle cure every 2 or 3 weeks by simply getting someone to stop drinking coffee. And I also, in the book, I have a chapter on tonics, a subject that's in ill repute in the West, but again, very much in high esteem in Chinese medicine, where these natural substances are seen as being useful in promoting longevity, resistance, and so forth. One of the tonics that I discuss is green tea, Japanese green tea. There's a very interesting body of medical literature now showing that green tea lowers cholesterol, has significant anti-cancer effects, may be beneficial for the body in other ways. So I think, as a general piece of advice, that if people in America could replace some of the coffee they're drinking with green tea, I think that would be a healthful change. It's milder as a source of caffeine than coffee, but will give a caffeine effect to people who want that, and you'll get some health benefits there which you don't get from coffee.
What do you think of decaffeinated coffee?
I think if you have reason not to drink coffee, you shouldn't drink decaffeinated coffee either, because it's not inert. It's got, first of all, enough caffeine in it to affect some very sensitive people, but it's also got a lot of the other substances in coffee that are irritating, especially to the gastrointestinal tract. So if somebody, for instance, has esophageal reflux, heartburn, gastritis, switching from coffee to decaffeinated coffee is not going to make for much improvement.
Dr. Andrew Weil is my guest, author of the book Spontaneous Healing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Weil is my guest. His new book is called Spontaneous Healing. You write about diet in your book, Spontaneous Healing, and one of the things you recommend is occasional fasting, either a fruit fast or a more complete fast. What do you think the benefits of fasting are?
I think there's several. First of all, just as a physical technique, fasting for one day frees up a lot of energy because the digestive system uses a great deal of energy to process food. So if, for example, you feel like you're coming down with a cold and you stop eating for a day, that makes a lot of energy available to the body's healing system. And
aren't you supposed to like feed a cold and starve a fever?
No, you know, I think I was told that the true interpretation of that is if you feed a cold, you're going to wind up with a fever that you have to starve. So that's a different way of interpreting
that. Oh, I never heard
proverb.
That one.
And that's the trouble with these proverbs.
That's right.
You know?
What do they mean?
Yeah, what do
I
they
never
mean?
Remember that you're supposed to starve a fever and feed a cold. Or.
But that's what I heard, is that if you go ahead and feed your cold, then you're going to wind up with a fever that you'll have to starve. At any rate, I do see this principle at work, that resting the digestive system for a day mm-hmm. can free up energy.
Uh-huh.
But also, short-term fasting, I think, is a very interesting psychological discipline, because many of us use food to satisfy emotional needs. It's a way of dulling mental feelings, emotional feelings that we're uncomfortable with. And if you shut that door for a day, it's very interesting to see what comes up. You know, I just think it's an interesting technique. It's an interesting practice to do.
What is a fruit fast, which isn't really exactly fast? You're still eating.
Sure. True fasting is really drinking nothing but doing nothing but water or herbal teas. I think a fruit fast, a fruit is very easy for the body to process. So it's a way of giving the digestive system a rest, or if you've overindulged in food and drink for a period of time, just giving your system fruit for a day. I think it's just a nice thing to do for your digestive system.
Mm-hmm. And how much fruit?
I think as much as you want. Realizing, however, that fruit is a fairly concentrated source of sugar, and that's especially true of fruit juice. I often find myself warning people about to be aware that fruit juice, especially, more than fruit itself, is a highly concentrated sugar source. And I think that it should be taken with moderation or diluted with water.
How do you decide what patients to take on? You're a kind of celebrity doctor at this point. Mm-hmm. You don't just have a regular practice, I'm sure. And I believe you have patients from around the world. So who makes the final cut?
My wife, who talks to people on the phone. And at the moment, you know, I was writing this book last year, so I suspended my practice for a while, and now I've been on the road a lot. So I have not been seeing patients. I was seeing patients in the spring. I teach at the University of Arizona, so I often have medical students other doctors observing practice with me. I like to see patients that I think I can help. So I want to see patients who are interesting, who seem motivated, who have medical problems that I think I have something to offer for. You know, it's a kind of feel that I develop of knowing what kinds of patients that I'm likely to work with best.
One last question. I think a fear that a lot of mainstream doctors have about alternative therapies is exploitation, mm-hmm. that patients will be exploited, that a doctor will say, well, through the mind-body connection, I will help you spontaneously heal.
I think that's a very legitimate concern. There mm-hmm. is a tremendous amount of medical nonsense out there. There's a lot of bad practitioners.
Who charge a lot of money.
Who charge a lot of money. And by the way, that applies to conventional medicine as well. So I think, you know, there is no substitute for being an informed, wary consumer of healthcare. I think you really have to educate yourself about what's out there, what it can do, what it can't do. And I really feel my mission is to try to train students and other doctors to do what I do, which is really to integrate, to put together the best aspects and practices of conventional and alternative medicine into new combinations, which I like to call integrative medicine, that really work from the premise that the body can get better. There's an enormous demand for this service. The supply of physicians doing it is very limited at the moment, and we've got to make it happen more.
Now, you said you believe in an informed, wary consumer. But that's just the thing. I mean, on the one hand, we're skeptical when we're shopping for the treatment. We don't want to go to the fraud. We don't want to go to the doctors that's going to exploit us and take our money. On the other hand, once we start the therapy, we want to really kind of believe in it so that, you know, the mind-body connection will really work in our favor. It's hard to be a skeptic and a believer at the same time.
Well, I like to think of myself as an open-minded skeptic.
Uh-huh.
And that's different from being a closed-minded skeptic, which is what I see very commonly in medicine today. You know, I think you should, you know, I feel that I'm willing to believe anything, but then I have to see proof of it. I have to see evidence. I have to be able to test something out in my own experience and know that it works. And I recommend that strategy to patients as well.
So being open-minded doesn't mean being a sucker.
No, absolutely not. And I think, as I say, I would like to see more people be open-minded skeptics.
Andrew Weil, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Andrew Weil is the author of Spontaneous Healing. He directs the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona in Tucson.
Don't send me no doctor, filling me up with all of those pills. I got me a man named Dr. Feelgood. And oh, yeah, that man takes care of all of my pains and my ills. His name is Dr. Feelgood in the morning. And taking care of business is really this man's game.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Bosnia?
We will be covering the story of Tuzla today. Also, we'll have a report from Tom Jelton, who will be reviewing the situation for us and giving us a little bit of the history of what has happened heretofore. Also, we're covering tobacco as a drug. The NAACP and its debate on funding attempts to pay its debts and to carry on its mission. We'll look at a new study which suggests that there is a connection between race and the amount of money that banks will lend. The president has spoken on base closings. There's a debate in the Senate on whether Senator Packwood's hearings should be public.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that now, as much as in the 60s, pianist and composer Andrew Hill is a maverick who never gets caught up in the conventions of the day, a musician who steps outside of time in more ways than one. There's a new box set of Hill's Blue Note sessions from the 60s. Kevin has a review.
Pianist Andrew Hill has always been elusive. Even in the 1960s, he didn't really fit in either of the big categories musicians got stuffed into, quote-unquote avant-garde or mainstream. This is really not so unusual, but Hill has a special genius for blurring these distinctions. His pieces follow the traditional plan, a melody statement, a string of solos over the chords, and then the melody again. But those melodies and chords can get slippery. Hill likes to play with time, too, stretching and contracting phrases. Listen to Flight 19, where he doubles and halves the tempo so often you can forget if it's a fast tune with slow breaks or vice versa. Oh, and check out his elliptical piano. Even when he plays the blues, Andrew Hill's phrases are more varied than most jazz pianists. Some sentences are short, but sometimes he lets a line run on like a long sentence that piles one thought on another, as if he didn't want to come up for air or bring a thought to a close, or just wanted you to wonder where he'd stop. ¶¶ This music is from a new box set from the mail order house Mosaic Records. The complete Blue Note Andrew Hill sessions, 1963 to 66, contains 7 hours of music, 7 sessions on 7 CDs. Then, as now, Hill works with great musicians. The saxophonists here are Eric Dolphy, Joe Henderson, John Gilmore, making 2 rare appearances outside Sun Ra's band, and Sam Rivers, who knows something about unpredictable phrasing himself. Andrew Hill kept recording for Blue Note after 1966, where this collection ends. Admittedly, his later albums were uneven, but I wish this box included a little from later sessions with saxophonists Booker Irvin and another Sun Ra regular, Pat Patrick. Mosaic boxes tend toward complete sessions, which is how this set is built, but that's not strictly true. There are no more than 2 takes of any tune, no matter how many were cut. Which is fine. Listening to jazz shouldn't be drudge work. Mosaic boxes are also known for their lavish documentation, which is sometimes less lavish nowadays. A few years ago, Mosaic would have included a discography of all of Hill's Blue Note sessions, so you could at least see what you're missing. But that's a quibble. The music is what counts, and almost all of it still sounds fresh.
Given Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice, he reviewed the complete Blue Note Andrew Hill sessions, 1963 to 66, on Mosaic Records. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Kathy Wolf, Nancy Updike, and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says the UN peacekeeping force is facing a widening catastrophe in Bosnia. He says the United Nations should begin immediate preparations for withdrawal. He told the Senate that this week's Bosnian Serb takeover of the Srebrenica enclave shows that the Bosnian refugees are defenseless and undefended by peacekeepers. Dole said the U.S. Senate could vote as early as next week on a proposal to lift the arms embargo against Bosnia. The White House says President Clinton has approved the base closings list. Spokesman Mike McCurry says the president reluctantly accepted the recommendations of the Defense Base Closure and Realignment Commission. The president had blasted the recommendations earlier today, saying they unfairly targeted Texas and California. California Senator Barbara Boxer agreed.
I am deeply saddened that the president has decided to accept the base closure commission's list. I know that the president was placed in a very painful position by a commission that I think was a rogue commission, by a commission that ignored both national security and cumulative economic impact. Nonetheless, despite the uproar that I know would have followed, and I know we would have had Senator Dole criticizing it, Newt Gingrich criticizing it, I believe the president would have been on solid ground to say no to the list.
The list closes 79 bases and realigns 26 others. Commissioners say it saves more than $19 billion over 20 years. President Clinton says the economic impact will devastate portions of California and Texas. The primary goal for the crew of the space shuttle Discovery has been completed. A satellite's been released into orbit. The Discovery began its 8-day mission this morning with a near-perfect takeoff from Florida's Kennedy Space Center. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has this report.
The 5-member crew has successfully deployed NASA's Tracking and Data Relay satellite. TDRS will eventually provide the agency with spacecraft communications from its geosynchronous orbit, 22,000 miles high. Today's deployment completes a network of 6 TDRS satellites. This particular satellite replaces a similar one that was destroyed along with the Space Shuttle Challenger nearly 10 years ago. This morning's launch was delayed for about a minute as officials looked into a problem with a receiver on the shuttle's external fuel tank. The receiver is used to destroy the shuttle in the event of an emergency during liftoff. The problem was cleared and the countdown continued. The crew will now conduct medical research and grow protein crystals for the remainder of their 8-day mission. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 5 points at 4,722. This is NPR. A heat wave is plaguing the middle section of the country. Temperatures above 100 have been recorded throughout Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. The temperatures hit at least 96 degrees in some parts of Wisconsin. The heat is testing power supplies and driving people indoors to air conditioning. The heat wave is expected to linger in the central United States until this weekend. Then it will move on to bother residents in New York and southern New England. Officials are warning about the dangers of heat stress. Symptoms include nausea, muscle cramps, and headache. They're advising rest, the application of cool, wet towels, and a phone call to the doctor. A former official of the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History has been charged with embezzlement. Prosecutors say Marcus Rodriguez diverted more than $2 million of museum funds over 5 years. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Marcus Arthur Rodriguez was the second highest-ranking official at the 80-year-old Natural History Museum. He also oversaw operations at the museum adjacent to the famed La Brea Tar Pits, where the bones of many extinct species have been discovered. His alleged embezzlement scheme was uncovered last year when new museum director James Powell could not rectify discrepancies in the accounts. The museum receives funds from the County of Los Angeles and also from a private foundation, and the two sets of books didn't match. Prosecutors charged that Rodriguez used the money to buy cars, expensive gifts, and pay off huge credit card bills. He also is believed to have paid off a relative's tax bill. Rodriguez is in jail, and bail has been set at $2 million. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The government says inflation at the wholesale level is under control. The Labor Department says its producer price index fell 0.1% last month. The June figure reflects a big drop in energy costs and the biggest decline in fruit prices in nearly 15 years. The government reports tomorrow on inflation at the consumer level. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. After failing to rally support for military intervention against Bosnian Serbs, France today backed down on its call for swift action. It said that it may be time for UN peacekeepers to leave Bosnia. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Defense Minister Charmillon, who will spend Bastille Day with French peacekeepers, said France does not believe that force alone could stop the Serbs. He said the government has always called for a diplomatic solution. Foreign Minister Hervé de Charette went even further, saying the way things stand now, it would be better to withdraw the peacekeepers. Fischer had criticized Dutch troops for failing to stop the Serbs from overrunning Srebrenica, saying they had become accomplices to ethnic cleansing. While the government is clearly frustrated and angry about the fall of the enclave, the French public is apparently indifferent as hordes set out on their summer vacation. French intellectuals are having trouble drumming up support for a protest against the Bosnian Serbs. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The State Department says that the United States has gotten information that, quote, Middle Eastern terrorists may be planning to attack a U.S. target somewhere in South America during July. The unusual announcement only added that additional information would be provided as it became available. The State Department has warned before that U.S. brokered moves toward Middle East peace could prompt guerrilla attacks. A year ago, 86 people were killed in a car bomb attack on a Jewish center in Buenos Aires. Argentina is seeking the extradition of 7 suspects from neighboring Paraguay. They're thought to be connected to the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group based in Lebanon. An audit prepared for the NAACP board reveals lavish spending by its former board chairman and executive director. The new NAACP leadership promises tighter fiscal controls in the future. NPR Cheryl Duvall reports from Minneapolis.
The audit surveyed the years between 1989 and 1994, a period during which the nonprofit civil rights organization amassed a nearly $4 million deficit. The study by the Coopers and Lybrand accounting firm was commissioned by former board chairman William Gibson after the association fired executive director Benjamin Chavis last year. A summary released this morning reveals that both men charged to the NAACP more than $144,000 in deluxe travel, accommodations, and personal items, including clothing. Gibson, a South Carolina dentist who narrowly lost re-election as chair of the board, was responsible for $112,000 in what the auditors called questionable expenses. In Minneapolis, I'm Cheryl Duvall.
On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was ahead a small fraction for a record close of 4,727. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin in very heavy trading. This is NPR. A radical folk singer who made a name for American imperialism has been elected mayor of Port-au-Prince, Haiti. That's according to results released today from elections held late last month. NPR's David Wellna has more.
47-year-old Mano Charlemagne got almost half the votes cast in the mayor's race, easily defeating the incumbent Evans Paul. Although Paul managed the campaign of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 5 years ago, the two have increasingly become political rivals, and Paul did not have Aristide's backing for his re-election bid. The mayor-elect Charlemagne has advised Aristide on grassroots organizations. His election is a setback for those who want Evans Paul to succeed Aristide when the presidency changes hands early next year. Paul has strong backing from the U.S. Embassy, but his poor showing in the mayoral race does not bode well for his chances in the presidential election slated for the end of the year. He has labeled the results of the June election invalid, alleging widespread irregularities in the voting and the vote count. I'm David Wallner reporting.
The head of the Food and Drug Administration says his agency and the White House are looking into new ways to regulate tobacco products. FDA Commissioner David Kessler says talks are focusing on ways of keeping children from starting to smoke. A report in today's New York Times says the FDA believes nicotine could be regulated as an addictive drug. That would give that agency power to control the sales of tobacco products. The Federal Trade Commission has jurisdiction over the tobacco industry now. A 22-year-old American man has died in Spain after being gored in Pamplona's famed Bull Run. Matthew Tasio of a Chicago suburb died at Navarra Hospital yesterday, shortly after one of 6 fighting bulls gored him in the abdomen. The Bull Run is held every morning during the 8-day San Fermin Festival in honor of the city's saint. Tasio's death is the first since 1980, when 2 Spaniards were killed. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.